Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
There's a TV show that's had various iterations over the years. Kids Say the Darndest Things. It started as a segment on Art Carney's radio show back in 1945 and was most recently hosted by Tiffany Haddish from 2020 to 2021. Over the near 80 years the show was on and off the air, the conceit stayed the same. A host talking to kids who could shift from brutal honesty to things that were likely lies to sheer make-believe in a matter of seconds.
Who's the most important man in the world today, in your opinion?
George Washington.
George Washington. That's right. He's married, isn't he?
Yes, sir.
You know who his wife is?
Miss America.
In the first episode of this undisclosed series, you heard the story told by A.J. Hutto, who was 6 years old when he saw his sister Adriana drown in the family pool. According to AJ, Adriana kept misbehaving while their mom Amanda tried to sleep, leading to Amanda dunking Adriana in the family pool, sending her to the school bus stop or a park, driving to get her, and bringing her back with a struggle before fatally drowning her. But was what he said the truth, a lie, or a flight of fancy he created in his head to try to make sense of finding his sister floating in the pool? And if we don't know the answer to that question, should he have been allowed to testify to the jury at his mother's murder trial, with what he said being the centerpiece of the state's case against her?
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice, The State versus Amanda Lewis. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the 8th episode of our deep dive series into the case of Amanda Lewis. Amanda was convicted of the 2007 drowning death of her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana, and she's been in prison ever since.
One of the biggest issues in the Amanda Lewis prosecution was whether her son, AJ, would be able to testify against her at trial. This was a critically important point because he was the only witness to the drowning. The prosecution claimed that AJ had seen his mother drown his sister and wanted Judge Allen L. Register to rule that AJ could testify to what he'd seen. Meanwhile, the defense alleged that AJ was incompetent to testify because it was clear that he had only seen the aftermath of the drowning and made up a story to try to make sense of it all. As we've noted, AJ was 6 years old when his sister drowned and when he was interrogated by police officers, and then he was 7 years old by the time of trial. Under the common law, back in the pre-Civil War days, AJ would have been deemed incompetent to testify. Back then, in most jurisdictions, children who were under 7 years old at the time of the crime were per se incompetent to testify at trial. Over time, though, things shifted. The watershed moment was the Supreme Court's opinion in Wheeler v. United States in 1895. In Wheeler, George Wheeler was convicted of murder. On appeal, Wheeler claimed that the victim's 5.5-year-old son should not have been allowed to testify against him at trial. In disagreeing, the Supreme Court noted that, quote, "the boy, in reply to questions put to him on his voir dire, said, among other things, that he knew the difference between the truth and a lie, that if he told a lie, the bad man would get him, and that he was going to tell the truth." The court then added that, quote, "in response to a question as to what the clerk said to him when he held up his hand, he answered, 'Don't you tell no story.'" Since Wheeler, these questions have been at the center of whether a witness is competent to testify despite being a child. Does the child understand the difference between the truth and a lie? And will the child tell the truth instead of a lie or a story?
So, how does AJ fare under this standard? Let's start by going back to his police interrogation on the day that his sister drowned. One part of that interrogation raised a red flag for me.
Do you have any pets?
I had 2 kitty cats and 2 dogs. And 2 dogs. One was dog and one was a child.
You got a dog in the house?
Only one, because I had to get rid of one because Charlie was eating up Miss Pliss and Max.
Who's that in the house? Max?
And then Miss Pliss and Max would start making a mess. Then they had to get put outside because they was eating. Then they started making a mess.
And which one do you have to get rid of? Charlie?
Yep, and then two of the dogs, kitty cats, got eaten by Charlie.
Uh-oh. When did you get rid of Charlie?
When he ate the cats. He was eating one in the morning, the ants. Charlie didn't eat Miss Pliss, the ants did. So Charlie ate squirrel.
When was that?
When we had Charlie and Darwin Squirrel and Miss Pliss.
Was that? Was that? Can you tell me when that was?
The ants ate Miss Pliss up in the morning, and Charlie ate Squirrel in the at night.
So you might imagine the issue I flagged. It seemed to me like AJ found the family's cats dead with ants on them, and then leaped to the conclusion that the cats had been eaten by ants or the family dog, maybe both. In other words, this was a question of cause and effect, as with Adriana's drowning. Under this theory, AJ saw his mom pulling Adriana from the pool and performing CPR, but with AJ thinking this was his mom killing Adriana rather than trying to save her. It turns out, though, that this whole theory was wrong, but not in the way that I expected, because the family never had a dog named Charlie who was sent away.
What animals or pets did you have at the time?
The only animals that we had was Alan's little miniature Doberman,
mm-hmm.
and I had just gotten a little Chihuahua from my aunt.
There was a video done when the police executed a search warrant at the Double Wide trailer, and here you can hear Alan's mini Doberman during the recording. Now you might wonder, is it possible that Amanda is lying? Maybe the family did have a dog named Charlie who was sent away, perhaps not for eating the family cats, but for some other misbehavior. Well, the issue with this is that Amanda also said the family never had any cats. Now again, you might doubt her, except for one crucial detail. Recall that AJ said his dog Charlie or the ants had eaten their cat, Miss Pliss. Well, it turns out that Miss Pliss was his grandmother's cat.
Now, when you were growing up, I think this is when you were growing up, maybe it was after, did your mom have a cat named Miss Pliss?
That was just brought to my attention, okay. And I did not remember that cat, but on the phone, we were talking about it, and I vaguely remember this cat, but not enough to be able to, like, describe it.
Right.
Because my mom, she's always had cats, always.
While Amanda didn't really remember Miss Pliss, her mother Brenda did. She was able to send us photos of the fully grown cat circa 1992. In other words, 15 years before Adriana drowned. And according to Brenda, Miss Pliss actually died years before AJ was born, with Brenda then later showing AJ photos of her and telling him that she had passed. So you see what happened here. AJ was told that Miss Pliss died. And in an attempt to try to make sense of her death, AJ created a fantasy from whole cloth. In this story, Miss Pliss was actually his cat, and he also had a dog named Charlie, with Charlie being sent away because either he or Ant ate Miss Pliss. This seems like clear evidence of AJ creating a fantasy to try to explain death in the very same police interrogation when he was telling the story of how his sister had died. When I talked to Amanda, she had no idea that AJ had said this.
Were you aware, up until this was just brought to your attention, that in his first police statement that AJ makes this statement about you having this cat named Miss Priss, and either your dog or the ants ate Miss Priss, and that was part of his story that he gave in the police interview, or is this something that was new information to you?
This was new information to me.
Okay.
This was also new information to AJ's grandmother, Brenda, based upon bad timing. You might recall from an earlier episode that Brenda was in the interrogation room with AJ when the police were questioning him, but that she had to leave based on the disturbing nature of what he was saying.
Can I go there?
Step out? Yes, fine.
Pretty much right after Brenda left, AJ told the story about Miss Priss, which Brenda could have corrected if she had still been in the room. But she wasn't, meaning that 6-year-old AJ was in the interrogation room with no blood relatives. It was just him, the two police officers, and Brenda's husband, Chuck. And it was pretty much at this point that things really went off the rails. In addition to the Miss Priss fiction, AJ took another trip to Fantasyland. When the police asked him about what he did when he saw his sister in the pool, he said that he screamed. That then led to a Q&A between lead agent Michael Raley and AJ that happened after the recording of the interrogation ended, but which was included in the transcript.
I wouldn't. I didn't get dunked. Adriana did. I was screaming at the police and the army men's and the fire department that Adriana could get wet. And the police and me was going to hide somewhere in the woods so we could get camouflaged. And then me and my big brother was going to hunt for deers with bows. My big brother only has shotguns with telescopes, and I don't. Mine only have no telescope. It only has a short telescope that shapes like a question mark.
Now, as odd as it might sound, the army men's detail does make some sense for reasons we'll explain in a later episode. But the rest of it? AJ and the police hiding in the woods and getting camouflaged so he could bow hunt deers with his big brother? His big brother, i.e. 14-year-old Alan Jr., having shotguns with telescopes? This is total fantasy, and it's a clear fabrication AJ intermingled with his story of seeing his sister in the pool. And according to Amanda, it was common for AJ to create stories about hunting and death. For instance, here was an anecdote she shared in her second of 3 police interviews. We don't have a recording of the interview, but here's the pertinent part of the transcript. Can you give me an accurate example of what he would say that would...
Well, he would say stuff like him and his daddy went hunting and they killed a big bear. Stuff like that, but then on other occasions, if he and Adriana are playing and she does something, he'll add a little bit more to it. Like if she would have sprayed the bottle of stuff, he said she sprayed it. Instead of just on one counter, she sprayed it all over the house. But both of them were the same that way. They would both add stuff, especially if it was toward each other and getting each other in trouble.
Did he actually tell somebody the bear story?
I think he told my stepbrother something like that, but I mean, that was just an example. But that's kind of stuff you would say. Now, I know the last time his daddy come and got him, and it was his daddy, his granddaddy and him, they went to Bonifay to get something to eat. They were spending the afternoon with him, and they stopped at the park around from our house, the Esto Park, and AJ come back and told me that all 3 of them seen an alligator, and they wrestled it and caught it.
And here was Amanda referencing this alligator story again in her 3rd police interview.
I know you said he tells stories. Does he ever tell stories on you?
Well, he'll tell stuff about everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, not being ugly or mean, but he'll just, I mean, like I told y'all the story, he said of me and his daddy and his granddaddy wrestling the alligator.
Questions about AJ's competency, such as these hunting stories, led to the court having an expert evaluate AJ's ability to discern the truth from lies and stories. Specifically, on Monday, February 11, 2008, just about a week before the start of trial, AJ was evaluated by Dr. Charles Madsen, a clinical psychologist in Tallahassee. Importantly, for reasons that will become clear, the evaluation was performed in a room without windows.
Let's start with the end of that evaluation. Dr. Madsen had asked AJ whether he'd ever been in the woods, and AJ again started telling a story about hunting animals. Unfortunately, by this point in the interview, AJ had kind of checked out. He was laying down in his chair and playing with another piece of furniture. Dr. Madsen had likely already registered young AJ's lie that he had hunted animals, so he stopped the questions before AJ might have gotten into some of the tall tales he'd told about bears and alligators. Turning to the start of the interview, Dr. Madsen followed a pretty standard protocol to see whether Ada could distinguish truth from lies in stories. Step one was to create the character of BJ, one letter off from AJ and the same age as him, to see whether AJ could tell whether BJ was lying in certain situations. Dr. Madsen told AJ to imagine that BJ was playing with a ball and broke a lamp, with BJ then telling his foster mother that his friend had come in and broken the lamp. When Dr. Madsen asked whether this was what had happened or whether it didn't really happen, AJ correctly answered that it didn't really happen. Dr. Madsen then told AJ to imagine that BJ was playing in the dirt and that BJ then told his foster mother that he got dirty by falling down in the dirt. He then asked AJ what BJ told his foster mother, and AJ responded that he had told her a lie. Finally, Dr. Madsen told AJ that BJ was sent to the corner as punishment, stayed in the corner, and later said that he stayed in the corner. AJ then correctly clocked that BJ was telling the truth. So far, so good. AJ was able to identify when the slightly fictionalized version of himself was telling the truth or a lie. But this then takes us to step two, Dr. Madsen pivoting to address AJ directly to see whether he could tell the truth from a lie in his current circumstances. The first thing that Dr. Madsen told AJ to do in the second step was to imagine someone saying it was raining in the building, followed by asking AJ whether it was really raining in the building. In response, AJ correctly clocked that it was not raining. This then led to the following Q&A.
So that would not be true, huh? What if they said there's windows and you can see the sun through the windows? What would that be?
The truth.
Yeah, no.
So in this very first question where AJ is asked to distinguish a truth from a lie in his current circumstances, he got it wrong. Because again, there were no windows in the room. AJ was asked to identify a clear lie or fiction, and he thought it was the truth. Dr. Madsen then explained to AJ why this was a lie, followed by a discussion of why lying is a bad thing. With AJ having failed this first test, Dr. Madsen returned to the fictional BJ. Specifically, he asked AJ to imagine that he promised BJ he would buy him an ice cream cone and then didn't buy him one. In response, AJ correctly clocked this as a lie. With AJ getting this right, Dr. Madsen again returned to AJ, leading to the following questions and answers.
So if you promised me that you were going to go outside and play with that little train and then you didn't, would you be telling me what you really did?
No audible response.
Why?
I don't know. Now, unfortunately, as noted, AJ's response to this first question is indecipherable, but it doesn't seem good, nor does his follow-up answer of, I don't know. Dr. Madsen then went back to the well one last time, telling AJ, let's go back to our little BJ again. Dr. Madsen then told AJ to imagine that BJ's foster mother had bought a big bag of cookies and made him promise not to eat them. But when his mom went to the other room to clean, BJ ate some of the cookies. AJ correctly clocked that BJ's behavior was a broken promise or a lie. And so, this then led into one final attempt with AJ himself. Dr. Madsen told AJ to assume that he had told him that he had a dog in his house. He then asked AJ whether this definitely meant that Dr. Madsen had a dog in his house. AJ answered yes, and Dr. Madsen told him he got it wrong. That just because he hears someone say something doesn't mean it's necessarily true, and that he should answer he doesn't know if he hasn't seen something himself.
These responses by AJ, as well as watching AJ's police interrogation, ended up being a big basis for one of Dr. Madsen's conclusions, that AJ, quote, tends to supply responses to questions even if he has no knowledge. Given that AJ's entire police interrogation involved AJ coming to conclusions about his mom drowning his sister, that seems like a pretty big deal. And it was. A second conclusion by Dr. Madsen was that AJ had difficulty understanding concepts such as the truth and promises. Of course, this is completely in line with the questions that AJ got wrong. But despite this, Dr. Madsen deemed AJ minimally competent to testify in a legal sense, but not a practical sense. Here's the way Judge Register put it. Quote, he indicates, first of all, that AJ is minimally, if at all, competent to testify as a witness, and then he goes on to explain why he doesn't think he is. Specifically, Dr. Madsen claimed that the law hadn't caught up to the science, meaning that science would deem AJ incompetent, while the law would allow him to take the stand. Going back to the Supreme Court's 1895 opinion in Wheeler, the legal standard centrally focuses on whether a child can tell a truth from a lie. And even though AJ struggled with this when asked questions about his own current circumstances, he did well with the BJ questions, so he still met the standard. And apparently there was a second expert, Dr. Netta Koteman, who concluded that AJ knew the difference between telling the truth and telling a lie. That's all we know about Dr. Koteman's evaluation of AJ, but it was good enough for Judge Register, who deemed AJ competent to testify at a hearing held 5 days before the start of Amanda's trial. And it was good enough for defense counsel, who did ask Judge Register to consider changing his ruling if AJ didn't appear up to snuff when he took the witness stand in trial. In response, Judge Register responded, quote, "I do agree with you that next week, if he gets on the stand and he starts answering questions to the exact opposite of what he answered them before, then we've got a problem." That then takes us to February 19th, 2008, the first day of Amanda's trial. A lot of folks love this cozy season we are in right now, but I'll be honest, I kind of dread it. For the most part, because you lose time. I feel like the days are so short between going back to school and losing sunlight. It feels like I just can't get everything done in my day that I need to. That is why I love Factor. Their chef-prepared, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy food that's comforting and delicious, no matter how hectic my day is. Factor has so much variety and more meals than ever. You can choose from a wider selection of weekly meal options, including premium seafood choices like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. There's so many things I love about Factor, not just the ease of it, but the fact that I know that I and my family, my kids, we are eating nutritious meals when we are eating Factor. Factor has so many GLP-1 friendly meals and a new Mediterranean diet option that's packed with protein and good for you fats. And while it's important that the food I eat is good for me, it is also important that your girl gets some flavor. And now for the first time, Factor delivers. They've got Asian-inspired meals with bold flavors influenced by China, Thailand, and more. From more choices to better nutrition, 97% of customers say that Factor has helped them live a healthier life. Factor customers feel the difference no matter their routine. They've got such great meal plans, but the one I go with every week is the high protein meal plan because every meal has 30 plus grams of protein. And at this age, and given that I spend a significant amount in the gym lifting weights, I need that protein, and I know my kids do too. So eat smart at factormeals.com/towardjustice50off. That is 50 off. And use the code TOWARDJUSTICE50OFF to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code TOWARDJUSTICE50OFF at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for an entire year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. A lot of you might not know this, but I have spent a lifetime struggling with my health and weight-related issues. I even wrote a book about it a couple of years ago called Fatty Fatty Boom Boom. In 2015, I got weight loss surgery, and that didn't quite do it. A couple years after that, I started strength training, and after years and years, like literally almost a decade of it, I finally lost 90 pounds and completely transformed my health. It wasn't until a few years ago that I learned about GLP-1 medications, and at that time, I still had a little bit ways to go, and I checked into it, except that my insurance didn't cover it, and it was really hard to navigate the system, so I kind of gave up. And I know a lot of us give up on all kinds of health-related issues when it comes to navigating insurance. That's why I love Row. Row clears that path by starting with a free insurance check to see if any GLP medications are covered by your insurance. There's no guesswork, there's no hassle, and you can feel good about taking the next step because Row has you covered. Rose Insurance Checker lets you know if you are covered for GLP-1s for free. All you have to do if you want to see if you're covered is just submit your insurance card, and Ro takes care of the rest. There's no paperwork, there's no hassles, there's no waiting on hold. Their insurance checker will send you a comprehensive report of your coverage details so you can make a decision that's right for your goals. What I wouldn't have done to have Ro be there for me 4 or 5 years ago when I was struggling with all of this. Now, not everybody gets covered, of course, but nearly half of all Ro members actually do have insurance coverage. So if you decide to move forward, Ro can help you understand if GLP-1s like Ozempic and Wegovy are right for you and your goals, but that's just the beginning. When you become a Ro member, you have support throughout the process, and you'll have access to your provider on demand for any questions. Look, I know that weight-related issues are not just about your appearance. I have had decades of experience on this issue. It's about how you show up in life. It's about your relationship. It's about how you feel. It's about your quality of life. It's about your health. It's about your mobility. And as I am aging, it is about my longevity. So if these issues and concerns occupy your time and your mind, there's no better time than the present for Ro to help you understand if GLP-1s are right for you and your goals and whether you can get covered by insurance. All you have to do is go to ro.co/justice for your free insurance check. That's ro.co/justice to see if your insurance covers GLP-1s for free. Go to ro.co/safety for box warning and full safety information about GLP-1 medications.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful, with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. And because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. Recently, I was able to get a beautiful painted hummingbird feeder from Uncommon Goods. I've tried a few of these from other companies and they haven't worked, but this beautiful hand-painted hummingbird feeder put out in my deck a few days ago, every single morning, I've seen at least one hummingbird feeding on it. Now, there's two key things I want to highlight about Uncommon Goods. The first is, when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And second, and this is critical for me, with every single purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. Overall, they've donated more than $3 million to date. So, shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/justice. That's uncommongoods.com/justice for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
At the start of trial, Judge Register returned to his response to defense counsel at AJ's competency hearing, noting that he might change his ruling based on what AJ said on the stand.
I would suggest, given what the state has suggested earlier, that the preliminary questions be asked of the state, then I would ask the attorneys at that point to approach bench, and we will discuss whether I feel that the child's answers today would change my mind from what I previously ruled. My previous ruling in this matter has been that the child's ability to relate facts as he observed them, his ability to understand the difference between the truth and a lie, and his ability to relate matters in a factual manner under State versus Lloyd have satisfied the court that he meets the requirement for being competent to testify. As I indicated at the previous ruling, previous hearing, if there was anything that came up today that would change my opinion that would be noted on the record, and we would then proceed accordingly.
This is a perfect procedure. Have the prosecution and defense ask AJ questions. Then have both sides approach the bench to discuss how Judge Register should rule, and specifically how he should rule on two issues. One, whether AJ was competent to testify, and two, whether he had to take the traditional oath if he were deemed competent to testify. Prosecutor Larry Basford got to go first. Basford began by asking basic questions like AJ's name, age, and where he went to school. And then he got to the key question from Wheeler at the heart of the competency question.
Do you know the difference between a truth and a lie or a story?
No, sir.
Okay.
And there it is, plain as day. When asked on the witness stand whether he knew the difference between the truth and a lie or story, AJ answered that he did not. That answer alone should have disqualified him from testifying under Florida law. For example, in the case Cottrell v. State, an appellate court in Florida reversed a ruling finding a child competent to testify because, quote, when asked if she knew what it means to tell a lie, she shook her head from side to side. And in RP v. Department of Children and Family Services, the same court reversed another ruling, even though a child witness said she could distinguish truth from lies, because the court, quote, posed few questions to clarify her ability to understand the difference between the truth and a lie. Nonetheless, Prosecutor Larry Basford pressed the issue with AJ, scrambling to try to establish his competence.
Can you tell this jury what a truth is?
Yes, sir.
All right. For instance, if I told you I had on a green shirt, I got on a green shirt?
No, sir.
What color shirt do I have on?
White.
Would that be the truth or a lie if I said I had a green shirt on?
A lie.
Now, if I said, AJ, you've got a white shirt on, would that
be
the truth? All right. Now, what happens to people or little boys that don't tell the truth?
They get a spanking and they get grounded.
Okay. Today, can you tell us the truth if I ask you some questions?
Yes, sir.
All right. Do you understand that's the most important thing?
Yes, sir.
Tell the truth.
Yes, sir.
This attempt at a save shouldn't have worked. The key case is Wade v. State. It's from the first department in Florida, just like Amanda's case. And the child in that case was 6 and a half, just a little younger than AJ. But unlike AJ, when asked, quote, do you know the difference between a truth and a lie? She responded, yes. So then why was she deemed incompetent? According to the court, quote, in the case at hand, although the child was asked to recollect facts during the competency determination, the questions were mostly directed towards recently observed events. The child was asked a few questions about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, but otherwise there was no attempt to demonstrate during voir dire that the child was capable of recollecting events which occurred between 8 months and 2 years prior. This same analysis applies to AJ. Indeed, he wasn't even asked questions about the recent past. He was asked questions about currently observed events, like the shirts that he and the prosecutor were wearing. And again, unlike the witness and Wade, AJ testified that he couldn't tell the difference between the truth and a lie.
And he didn't just say this once. Here's the very first question that defense counsel Walter Smith asked AJ on cross-examination.
AJ, Mr. Smith, this gentleman standing right over here, has a couple of questions he wants to ask you, okay?
Okay.
All right, Mr. Smith.
AJ, Mr. Basford asked you if you could tell us the difference between the truth and a lie, and you said no, sir. Is that what your answer was?
Yes, sir.
So again, AJ repeated that he couldn't tell the difference between the truth and a lie. But did he at least know the meaning of the truth and the meaning of a lie? That's where Walter Smith went next.
Can you tell me what a lie is?
It's not the truth.
Can you tell me what the truth is?
It's not a lie.
Again, there's no there there. AJ knew that the truth and lies are in opposition to each other, but couldn't, or at least didn't, say anything more. This then took Walter Smith to the following set of questions.
If I told you your mother was in the courtroom here today, would that be the truth?
No, sir.
That would not be the truth. Why is that? Because she's not in the courtroom?
No, sir.
Okay. So your mother is not in this courtroom?
No, sir.
Okay. And you're telling me that that is the truth, that your mother is not in the courtroom?
Yes, sir.
Now, mind you, Amanda was sitting 10 feet away from AJ at the defense table. The defense team actually measured it for their motion for a new trial. And yet, here we have AJ saying his mom was not in the courtroom, that this was the truth. These questions by the defense then set up the most dramatic and devastating moment in the trial. Here was Prosecutor Larry Basford trying to clean up what had just happened.
That woman sitting right there between them, have you ever seen her before?
Yes, sir.
Who is that?
My mother.
Now you recognize your mother?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, look at me, AJ. This time we're ready to proceed, Judge.
Now you're just hearing the audio, but when AJ sees his mom, he starts weeping, which is totally devastating. And it likely wasn't only devastating for AJ. You can easily imagine the jurors seeing AJ weep and thinking that he was terrified of his mother. In fact, this video of AJ has been shared across social media and on national TV specials about Amanda's case. AJ's testimony and this entire trial are also up on Court TV for anyone who wants to watch it. But if you watch the trial on Court TV, you're missing an important bookend. True, AJ does cry when he sees his mother. The Court TV footage of the trial, though, cuts out after he finishes testifying. But the 2020 special, What Did AJ See?, airs the full footage. Specifically, after AJ was done testifying, he got off the witness stand, looked over at his mother Amanda, gave her a big smile, and waved at her.
And AJ's parting gesture as he leaves the stand? A smile and a wave at his mother.
So here's a kid who just testified that his mom drowned his sister, and he ends his testimony by smiling and waving at his mother. For me, this is crucial context for his crying when he first saw his mom. Your mileage may vary, but my own take is that AJ cried because he hadn't seen his mother in months. He wasn't afraid of her, just shocked to see her. And then, the smile and wave reinforces lack of fear. Again, just my take, and for what it's worth, here was Amanda's own take.
There's a moment right after AJ testifies when he's being taken off the stand and he looks at you and smiles and waves. Do you remember that moment in the courtroom and how that made you feel?
I do. I'll always remember that. It hurt my feelings because it's almost like in my mind, I felt like he remembered what we actually did have. And I felt like they're trying to take that from him. Mm-hmm. And in their mind, they're trying to paint me to be this person that I wasn't. So for that little glimmer that he had, I felt like maybe he won't forget. Maybe they won't be able to take that from him. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it seems like they have.
That taking away that Amanda spoke about started with what Prosecutor Larry Basford did in the moment. You heard it a minute ago. With AJ openly weeping, Basford didn't ask the judge to press pause and allow AJ to compose himself. Instead, he tried to push forward, telling Judge Register that they were ready to proceed. It feels like Larry Basford hoped that the judge was caught up in the emotion of the moment because, recall, this wasn't what was supposed to happen. Judge Register specifically said that after the parties were done with their questions, they were supposed to approach the bench to argue, one, whether AJ was competent to testify, and two, whether he'd be required to take the oath. But none of this happened. Right after Basford said they were ready to proceed, Judge Register ruled as followed.
This time we're ready to proceed, Judge.
You may proceed. I still object to these witnesses.
And your objection's noted for the record. Previous order of the court is still in place.
And so, there you have it. Without even the administration of the oath or anything like it, AJ was ruled competent to testify. But as we noted in episode one, when the substantive questioning of AJ started, he seemed to be anything but competent.
What happened to Adriana when your mother woke up?
She got grounded.
All right. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell us about that.
I can't remember.
You can't remember?
No, sir.
Were you inside or were you outside?
Inside.
Did you go outside that day?
No, sir.
Now, at some point, did you and Adriana go outside to play that day?
Yes, sir.
What were y'all playing?
Tractors.
Tractors?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where were you playing with those tractors, AJ?
I can't remember.
All right. How is it that Adriana got drowned that day, AJ? Can you tell me?
No, sir.
All right. Let me ask you some other questions then.
Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will show you all your expenses in one place, including subscriptions you forgot about. I can't tell you the number of times I have realized years in that I have like more than one account for any given service because I have signed up multiple times using different email addresses and then forgot all about it. But Rocket Money helps clean all that up. And all you have to do is get on the app. If you see a subscription that you no longer want or something you didn't even know you had, Rocket Money will help you cancel it. Their dashboard lays out your entire financial picture, including your bills due dates and paydays, in a way that's easy to digest and, you know, doesn't get overwhelming. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you. Isn't that crazy? The app automatically scans your bills to find opportunities to save and then goes to work to get you better deals. They will even talk to customer service so you don't have to. Rocket Money has saved users over $2.5 billion, including over 880 million in canceled subscriptions alone. Their 10 million members save up to $740 a year when they use all of the app's premium features. Think about what you could do with an extra $740 a year. So cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/justice today. That's rocketmoney.com/justice. rocketmoney.com/justice. Now, you might recall that with increasingly leading questions, AJ did eventually testify that his mom drowned his sister. But you might also recall that on cross-examination, AJ later testified that his sister either fell or climbed into the pool from the wagon that was pulled up next to it. And so AJ's testimony was riddled with inconsistencies. Despite what he said during his psychological exam, he testified twice that he couldn't tell the difference between the truth and a lie or a story. He said he was inside for the drowning, then outside. He said he didn't know how his sister drowned, then he said his mom did it, then he said his sister fell or climbed into the pool from the wagon. Now, recall what Judge Register said at the end of the competency hearing. Quote, I do agree with you that next week if he gets on the stand and he starts answering questions to the exact opposite of what he answered them before, then we've got a problem. After Amanda was convicted, the defense pointed this out to Judge Register as part of a motion for a new trial, and here is how he responded.
At the trial, after hearing some preliminary questions from both the state and the defense, I announced that I'd heard nothing that would cause me to recede from my earlier decision that AJ was competent to testify. And while I agree that he gave some answers in court that were inconsistent with answers he gave in other interviews, the consistency of one's testimony is not a test for competency to testify. I still feel at this time, as I felt at trial, and as I announced in my decision prior to trial after viewing those videotaped depositions or videotaped interviews, that AJ is competent under Florida law to testify.
It is hard to reconcile what Register said before and after trial. Before trial, he made it clear that inconsistencies by AJ would cause him to change his ruling on competency. But then when AJ did exactly that, both with questions on truth versus lies and what he saw on the day of the drowning, Judge Register ruled that those inconsistencies were not grounds for finding him incompetent. And as you heard, a big basis for this was his police interview. The 2020 special, What Did AJ See?, showed Dr. Stephen Sissy the video of AJ's police interview. You might recall that this was the one that was conducted in an interrogation room by two police officers, neither of whom had training in interviewing children.
The police officer who interviewed AJ admits he has no formal training.
Yes.
Is that a problem?
Yes, it is a problem.
How do you feel the police did when you watched that?
It was a highly insufficient interview.
Dr. Stephen Sissy, an expert in children's testimony, reviewed AJ's case for 2020. He says extra care is required to interview kids, especially AJ, whom he describes as developmentally delayed, similar, in fact, to a typical 4.5-year-old child.
It's not something that you can do by the seat of your pants, and I think that was evident in the law enforcement interview. They didn't structure it right. They didn't ask the right follow-up questions. I think they misunderstood some things he said.
In his Cornell lab, Sissy's experiments show that children can be manipulated over time into making outrageous and untrue statements. In one test, children are told a rabbit was at their school. They never see it, but they claim that they did.
Remember when Mumfrey's rabbit was loose in your school? Did you see him eating carrots or lettuce?
Was he black or was he white?
He was yellow.
We've had children say things about going up in the Eiffel Tower and releasing balloons.
And they seem very convincing, don't they?
They really are convincing.
To get another take on what was done with AJ, I reached out to Dr. J. Zoe Klempis, a professor at UC Irvine whose research focuses on how children remember and report about their past experiences. One of the questions I asked her was about the importance of having someone with a relevant training present for the first questioning of a child being asked about a traumatic event.
How important or unimportant is it that someone with that experience and training and education is there in that interrogation room?
My gut reaction is to say crucial, because that first interview is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's where you're potentially getting the child's most fresh and authentic reaction to the event, but it's also a really, really risky time for setting the child's memory off course.
Mm-hmm.
So if the questioning in that context is poor and not being monitored, not being administered by someone who has really high quality training on how to do it, it can be permanently damaging to the child's statement.
Got it.
As you might recall, mere hours after AJ was interrogated by the police officers, he was questioned by Sarah Campbell, a skilled and experienced member of the Child Protection Team. And from back in episode 1, you might remember her being asked a crucial question at trial.
In the interview, did you ask him specifically if he actually saw his sister getting dumped?
I did.
And what was his answer?
Objection, yeah.
And then, after the prosecution pursued this objection to no avail, she answered as follows.
And what was his response to that question?
AJ denied seeing her get dunked.
Okay.
And so, as you might imagine, I asked Dr. Klemfis whether AJ's statement to the police that he saw his mom drown his sister, or his statement to Sarah Campbell that he didn't see her drown, was more reliable.
Two officers, although I'm sure well-meaning and doing their best, if they're making errors and they're questioning that are damaging the child's statement, and the CPS follows up that same night with a higher quality interview. I mean, it's hard to say. So if the child's been sort of disoriented or had false suggestions implanted, you know, even unintentionally by that first interview, they could carry over into that second interview, even if the questioning practices are pristine in the second interview.
Right.
So in some senses, they're hard to extract from each other.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, generally speaking, you know, I would take an interview from a trained CPS, you know, and assume that it's going to be higher quality than somebody who doesn't have training in specifically talking to children.
Right.
And especially if they're both the same day, you know, that type of delay is probably usually not substantial enough to do, you know, get their memory a big hit.
Right.
Directly after asking this, I wanted to get into a central question that has divided discussion of this case online. As noted, AJ told Sarah Campbell, the child protection team, that he did not see his sister drown. And when he met with a mental health therapist, he also drew Adriana being drowned while he was in the garbage can tree in front of the trailer, along with the words "can't see." And as we noted, that's consistent with someone in the tree not being able to see the pool, which was behind the trailer. Those who believe Amanda is innocent think that this is proof that AJ didn't see the drowning and came up with a story to try to explain what had happened. On the other hand, those who believe that Amanda is guilty think that AJ's statement and drawing were him trying to repress the trauma of seeing his mom drown his sister. And they also believe that AJ changing critical details of his story at least 13 times was the result of the trauma messing with his memory. This is a primary research area for Dr. Klemfis, so I asked her about whether such repression rearrangement is supported by the science. Here was her response.
Yeah, so there are some memory wars, so-called, that happened years and years ago. They're kind of seeing a resurgence right now. And the big question of the memory wars is whether, you know, trauma, extreme stress can cause you to sort of repress what you've seen and damage your access to that memory. And, you know, the basic conclusion from the scientific community was no. In fact, what stress and trauma and more typically do is make you not be able to forget and make you relive the experience and make it very vivid and salient to you. So, you know, that would be more of my assumption, is that this child is going to be sort of forced to relive the event. They may not want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the right time about memory versus reporting, so my guess would be this would make it a very salient and memorable experience for the child, especially for central, crucial details, and that they might have trouble forgetting it even when they want to.
Right.
But that they may be, you know, that type of stress and trauma may make them reluctant to discuss it. So it may make it more difficult to get them to, you know, report it to you. But it would probably make it, unfortunately, really easy to retrieve and remember.
Sticking with the science, it's now been 17 years since Amanda's trial, and I wanted to see whether Dr. Klemfis had the same take on the gulf between the science and the law as Dr. Madsen. You might recall that Dr. Madsen concluded that AJ was competent under the law, but not the science, based upon the gulf between the two.
And when you look at it from a legal context and a psychological context, do you tend to find that the law currently has it right? There's a gulf between what psychology says and what the legal system says.
We've made progress, but there's still a pretty big gulf, yeah.
Got it. And so when we're looking at that legal context, what are we looking at in terms of whether a child is competent enough to testify about a traumatic event that they say they experienced?
Yeah. So competence is an interesting one because sort of from the developmental psychology perspective, it feels like the field has kind of put it to bed. Like, this is actually not a good idea, not helpful mm-hmm. to even try to establish competency with kids. Because we don't really see evidence that competency examinations of any form are predicting their performance. So that's one goal. it persists. I mean, so like a lot of the work that you'll see is maybe from like 10, 15 years ago, including my own, specifically on this competency issue, because we don't see a strong connection.
As an evidence professor, this is pretty disturbing, that the competency exams we do for children can't really tell us whether they'll tell the truth or a lie in the stand. And so I followed up to make sure that this is what she was saying.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying if we have two groups of children and they're taken through a competency examination and group one fails under the law, group two passes, is your point that that's not meaningfully telling us which group of children is telling the truth or telling an accurate story versus which is not?
Typically not.
Okay.
Typically not. So, I mean, first of all, what we see is that from very early on, at least on sort of the strict, most jurisdictions legal definition of competence, which my understanding is typically just, can they identify truth and lie? Mm-hmm. And that's not universal everywhere, but typically my understanding is just, can they tell what a truth is? Can they tell what a lie is? And then in some places, right, do they understand that they should be telling the truth? That's morally important.
Right.
And especially for the identification questions, typically kids can do that pretty much at ceiling or, you know, reliably most kids can do this by 3 years old. And so what we're getting is that almost all the kids that we ask this question of, and this is legally true too, right, that most kids are passing competency. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know a lot about those rare cases where they're not.
And so this is where things are tough with AJ. As Dr. Klempis notes, when asked, almost all children do say they can distinguish the truth from a lie, but simply saying this is kind of meaningless. On the other hand, AJ falls into the rare case category of a kid who actually says he doesn't know the difference between the truth and a lie. And as Dr. Klempis notes, there's just not really any data on this type of kid. It's also important to note that AJ was actually asked if he knew the difference between the truth and a lie or a story. And that last category could be tricky, given AJ's tall tales about Miss Priss, hunting bears and alligators, and shotguns with telescopes. And so, I asked Dr. Klempis about the question that AJ was asked.
Is it helpful or unhelpful to think about a story as a subset of a lie or a completely different category?
Yeah. My recommendation would always be ask the kid how they define it, right? Mm-hmm. What is a story? I mean, just to find out, because it could vary by kid. I mean, it's tough as soon as you start throwing in extra terms. I mean, even this, having this weird forced choice between truth and a lie or story. Mm-hmm. Now you don't know what the kid's trying to distinguish. They may just be confused by the complexity of the question at that point.
Right.
I don't know. So I don't know how this kid is defining a story and whether or not a story is more socially acceptable than a lie, right? Mm-hmm. So kids are pretty reliable from much earlier, you know, much earlier than 7 on average. They're pretty good at knowing lie is bad. So lie, they can pretty quickly recognize not good, don't like it, morally wrong. Mm-hmm. Story, I would say, is more of a gray area. I don't have data to speak to this, but, you know, especially in U.S. culture, we encourage good storytelling mm-hmm. as a positive personality characteristic. So we actually prefer people who tell elaborated, not accurate stories because they're entertaining. And even young kids can do this around the age of this witness. They recognize that good stories aren't always accurate, but they're not as morally wrong as a lie.
All this takes me to maybe the most surprising part of my interview with Dr. Klempis, at least from my perspective. If you've ever watched a trial or a TV show or movie about one, you've probably seen witnesses taking the oath. You know what we're talking about, putting your hand in the Bible and promising to tell the truth. When I spoke to Dr. Klempis, I expected her to have the same issue as me, which was AJ being deemed competent to testify despite saying he couldn't distinguish between the truth and a lie or a story. On the other hand, I fully expected her to say that a child taking the oath is more performative than anything, and the judge allowing AJ to testify without taking one was small potatoes. But it turns out I had it all wrong.
It's kind of this difference between understanding and actually implementing, right? like adults lie, even though we know we're not supposed to lie.
Right.
What we do find is that they need to have like a really, really basic level of competence sometimes. So sometimes they have to at least be able to understand a basic oath to be able to understand they're supposed to be telling the truth. So if they can understand the word truth, if you're using truth in a basic oath, then they should be good to go. That the oath itself is what carries more weight and has more predictive ability than their actual understanding.
I then return to this question of not requiring AJ to take the oath, despite clear indications in the record that he was prone to storytelling that was not grounded in reality.
Right, so the legal competency doesn't necessarily predict performance. So, and then there's being able to predict or convince him to tell the truth when on the stand. Mm-hmm. And yeah, having a basic understanding that he knows which of his stories are true and which aren't would be important.
Right.
You asked me earlier about whether it was unusual or problematic that the judge didn't require him to take the oath. I do think that's problematic because that would sort of shows him the seriousness of it and that it sort of reaffirms that he should be telling the truth.
In the end, it's tough to say whether AJ was testifying to the truth, stories, or some combination of the two. What is clear is that Amanda's case has been discussed ad nauseum online for 15 years in a way that's allowed clear lies to calcify, making Amanda's case like so many other wrongful conviction cases involving women. All across the internet, you can see people saying that Amanda was a cold-blooded, bad mother who couldn't provide for her children and lost not one, but two of them due to bad parenting or a short fuse. A review of the record reveals, however, that almost all of the allegations against Amanda are simply not true. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got two additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer three simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at RabiaSquared2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, Just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.